As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Oh, I say, it's amazing.
He does it tame and tame and tame again.
Crank up the music, charge your glass. This nation is going to dance all night.
The purest co-commentary of all time, Formula One Cup Finals, Jonathan Pearce's multi-generational set-piece woes, officially welcoming the doubler to the language of football, Scontro Salvezza, and the previously untold story of how three teenagers with a handful of 20p's and a copy of Championship Manager 97-98 almost turned the world of football transfers on its head. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 98 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me, first of all, is Nick Miller. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Not bad, thanks. Going to hit you with this one straight away. Stefan Bienkowski on Twitter pointed out this weekend that Joe Cole, who was on punditry duty for Chelsea versus Manchester City, declared that the game would be a cat-and-mouse game of chess, which I quite like how he's mixed it up. I mean, if you put them together, it does has a kind of cumulative effect of what you're talking about. But all it did was conjure in my head the next question: who would win a game of chess between a cat and a mouse?
I mean, my brain went instantly to Tom and Jerry, so it's got to be the mouse, I think. But it wouldn't necessarily be Jerry / the mouse would, you know, get checkmate or whatever. He would engineer something so there was like a massive hammer in the night or something, and just smack the cat over the head with it, and one of those kind of cartoon bumps would appear on poor old Tom's head.
Yeah, Tom would lose it. And like petulantly throw the board up in the air or something like that. So the game wouldn't finish. But yeah, would it be interesting to see Joe Cole do the punditry on that nonetheless. But welcome. Alongside you is David Walker. How's it going?
Yeah, good. Very well.
You were at Watford.
I was.
For what was described as a breathless 1-1 draw with Newcastle. Was it breathless?
I've told a few people this already and their reactions have been incredulous. But when Watford scored the goal that went on to be disallowed for offside, Josh King, in the 87th minute, I nearly fainted.
What?
Wow.
Like, I don't know what happened, but like, I just felt really lightheaded. You know, like, I don't know if you have ever fainted before, but some, you know, your vision just starts to go very... You can sort of imperceptibly feel that your eyes, something's wrong, and your eyes are sort of funny. And I just had it was only for like 3 seconds. All the while I was sort of screaming my head off and going mad because I thought we'd won this game out of nowhere. But luckily I was on the last seat in the row and I had a metal thing next to me that I literally just held on to for dear life for 3 seconds and then sort of was fine. But yeah, it was a very strange experience because I bought a ticket last minute and there was literally like a handful of tickets left in the stadium. And the one I ended up with was right in front, literally right in front of the Newcastle fans, who about 2,000 and all of them or whatever, and they didn't stop chanting and doing all the songs. They were brilliant for the
whole
game.
What was the ratio of shirts on, shirts off?
Weren't that many shirts off, really, but there was, although I did see a very large man took his shirt off when they scored their goal. But I was so close, I could see into their eyeballs. Like they were staring at me. And I was in a part of the ground where quite a lot of kids and family, so I sort of took it upon myself to be like the chief provocateur to the Newcastle fans, which in the aforementioned VAR incident left me very much with egg on my face after I celebrated the goal twice thanks to the referee's shoddy arm movements. He looked like he gave the goal, but he hadn't, and then it was a shambles. But it was breathless, very much so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, surprised to see away fans, nearly fainted. Congratulations on going to your first ever football game.
What do you think?
In the Victorian era.
What do you
era?
Think the etiquette would be if the away fans were that close? If you actually had fainted, you know, you passed out, you topple over the barrier that you're holding on to, and I assume there was some kind of one of that's sheeting in between the two fans. You fall onto that, you've passed out. What's the etiquette for the away fans at that point? Do they kind of rib you mercilessly, or do they go, oh Jesus, actually this is serious, let's let's help him out?
I think quite possibly they might have picked me up and thrown me around like a beach ball.
I think it's the same rules as when someone goes down with cramp. The opposition
should help,
sort of duty bound silently to go and help you, even though they don't know why. I'd say it's similar, but tarpaulin potential dramas worth worrying about. The reason I brought this up in the first place, of course, I realise people listening to this may be concerned that we are the 17th podcast to have got to this, but it doesn't matter. This is BBC Radio Newcastle's John Anderson reacting to Jacob Murphy squandering the chance to win the game for Newcastle, and it's sensational.
Mr. Runnan does. Can he play a colleague through? It's Jacob Murphy released. Murphy one-on-one. Jacob Murphy to win it. Net!
Now, Dave, obviously, on the face of it, this is utterly sensational, but I put it to you that there is absolutely no other type of finish that could have elicited that response from John Anderson.
Yeah, it was pathetic, wasn't it? And I was screaming at absolutely top of my lungs to Peter Atibo, who was the player chasing Jacob Murphy. I was just, bring him down, foul him, take him down, take him down.
We're all Roy Keane at this moment.
Just do it. Just it's the last minute. Just do it. Do it the Solskjaer. Again, you know, when he did that. And then I was convinced he was going to score. Freedom of the half.
Yeah,
and any sort of firm contact of the ball probably would have been. He tried to do a little pathetic little dink.
Well, yeah. I mean, Nick, what type of finish could anger an ex-pro from the 1980s more than an attempted dink finish in the latter stages of a game that's delicately poised at 1-1?
Yeah, and our colleague Owen Shearer on the Match of the Day said something along the lines of, just put your foot through it. there's no other rational or reasonable response to that kind of finish, I think. Just put your foot through it.
I've decided in retrospect that it's some sort of government conspiracy that Jacob Murphy's been roped into to turn us all into proper football men, like to find the point at which we all turn into proper football men. And I think that's the closest we've got. More on that theme very shortly. The first up for the adjudication panel this time. Nick, with a heavy heart, I must announce that Formula One is at it again. This is from CCMU, who says, some solid work from Red Bull Racing's Christian Horner on Channel 4.
Now look, the next 12 weeks will determine whether we win a championship or not. And we've got 8 cup finals, basically, to ensure that we deliver at our very best.
Now, I could be bothered to go back and check, but I'm pretty sure that Formula One has done this before on this podcast. So we may be retreading old ground, but I'm not happy with cup finals in Formula One. I would even go as far to say that Formula One is the furthest sport away from the concept of a cup final than it's possible to get.
Yeah, and also the sort of nature of it is, but the nature of Formula One, as I understand it, and I do my very best not to understand it, each race is treated as quite a significant discrete event. So if in their version of what a cup final would be is just every race anyway, isn't it? I don't know. As I said, I've done my best not to really understand Formula One. Now, so
the principle's kind of there, Dave, because his driver, which I think is Max Verstappen, is obviously trying to win the Drivers' Championship. So the parallels are sort of there, But I still don't like it.
Again, I think where it sort of falls down is the point scoring system in F1. Is there such a range of outcomes that it's not definitive necessarily at all? You know, because
it's not make or break
Hamilton,
eight times, is
and
it?
it's also not a direct head to head. There are loads of other drivers and teams involved.
Yeah, that's true. That's true too. Yeah. Yeah, don't like it.
Tell you what it brought to mind for me, though, and this is the effect that this podcast is having on my brain.
Good.
It just, you know, immediately brought to mind Phil Neville, because Phil Neville has been using the old cup finals routine in almost every game that he loses in MLS at the moment with the hapless Inter Miami. And it just sort of made me think about like an alternate, well, not even an alternate universe, but just literally perhaps the events of future years. You could easily see David Beckham at one stage in his life deciding to be involved in a Formula One team. And then who would be the team principal but none other than Phil Neville?
Yes. He's earnest enough to be Formula One, actually. I can see him giving a sort of grave appraisal of his team's chances in the pit lane beforehand. I don't know. But yeah. But, you know, in revenge, I feel like, Nick, we should stop using pole position when a team might sign a player. Just in protest. That's it. We're not going to use your phrase anymore.
Yeah, it's this. I mean, I don't know whether we are overestimating the power of this podcast that we can you can sort of put forth edicts like that. That, you know,
no one else is doing it. That's all I'm saying. No one else can be bothered. Okay, more familiar ground for the Football Clichés podcast, Dave. Although I am slightly concerned, much like fossil fuels, that the supply of David Seaman chuckles may be showing signs of running out. He was interviewed alongside Aaron Ramsdale after the latter's heroics against Tottenham on Sunday afternoon. It was a predictable type of banter. It just gave me the first signs that maybe he won't be chuckling for much longer.
Obviously such a legend at this football club, but in England as well. So finally got the chance to meet him, and hopefully sooner rather than later we can sit down and have a chat.
Is he somebody you used to watch a lot as a young goalkeeper, Aaron?
I'm not that old.
Sorry, he asked me about that one.
Just little dregs of chuckles from Seaman there. I'm starting to think he might be bored of chuckling. Might be finally bored of it.
Do we think that, I mean, has the chuckling been a front all along, do you think? And this is what it's taken to kind of finally chip through the facade that...
What, Aaron Ramsdale suggesting that he's just too young to have witnessed David Seaman in his prime?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
And, you know, underneath all the chuckling, David Seaman has just been a deep sea of melancholy all along. And this is it.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
But yeah, Dave, do you fear for Seaman?
No, I think he's crisis-proof. There's no chuckle crisis here, I don't think. I think that was still hearty enough for me to not worry too much.
I mean, suggesting that one party in a football conversation is older than the other person is, I mean, that's very comfortable football banter territory.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into this. Maybe we are safe as houses.
And you would have thought that Seaman, obviously, he arguably the peak of his career was when he was older than a lot of other footballers. So you would assume he's kind of, you know, pretty fine with that.
Yeah, he's a goalkeeper. He's got a margin for error there. He's not old until he decides. So, yeah, okay.
The way that Ramsdale said that, though, was like, normally it's kind of the other way around. He wasn't sort of, he was like saying, oh, I'm not that old. It was almost like he was insulted by the thought, as opposed to sort of having a dig at Seaman for being old, which was a strange way round.
It just, doesn't like the idea of maybe hitting his late 20s and reaching his goalkeeping
peak. Yeah, because he's not old. That's the sort of thing that you say when you are old. I'm not that old, when you actually are nearly that old. But he's actually young. He's obviously not that old.
That was very true, very true. Just re-emphasising the difference in age between him and David Seaman. Yeah, just to ram it home even more. Speaking of old people sounding slightly disgruntled, here's Jonathan Pearce's commentary on Match of the Day for Aston Villa's goal against Manchester United.
It's a good delivery into that area. Who was standing on the near post? Modern game? No one. And that's why there's a goal. Put a fullback on the post. Why, if it worked so well for generations, should it not work now? He doesn't mind. Villa are ahead.
Nick, it was kind of understandable textbook disgruntlement for a bit, and then he started talking about it being okay for generations, and that was the real twist for me. That's where it really went into a different realm altogether.
There's also it feels like there are two competing like football truisms here, because that was obviously a header scored at the near post, and as we know, goalkeepers should never be beaten at the near post. So, yeah. So what is it? Does the keep if the keeper shouldn't be beaten at his near post? What does he need the guy the defender standing on the near post? What to do?
Well, I mean, you've raised a very interesting extra concept there, but I would say the being disappointed to be beaten at your near post phenomenon, Dave, does not apply to corners and headers.
No, I don't think so, because the goalkeeper's not standing at the near post.
Mm.
That's the issue. Yeah.
Let's be fair.
Yeah.
Let's be fair.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
If anything, it's harder because it's the reaction times and that. But yeah, it's more positioning. But yeah, let's let goalkeepers off with that one. But let's not let Jonathan Pearce off, Dave, because it just went on a little bit longer than it ought to, especially for Match of the Day highlights. I mean, they could have edited some of the irritation out, I feel.
I mean, it's just such a classic criticism. But the problem with it is, I want to sort of rail against it and say, oh, no, because, you know, zonal marking, blah, blah, blah. You know, they've all got systems and they've worked out that this is the best way of doing corners. But he is right. Like, if there was a bloke standing there, he probably would have headed it away. So,
but oddly enough, it happened to be another case study for the is the player interfering with play standing in front of the goalkeeper debate? And of course, if there had been a player in the post, that wouldn't have been an issue. So that's precisely why teams don't put players on the post, I'm told. But that's too much technical. But too much tactical.
I did love the delivery though, and it was sort of a Jonathan Pearce's spin on the Andy Gray imaginary conversation. You know, he's introduced a third party into this. It's not the player talking to the ball.
He was speaking to everyone. He was talking to the players. He was talking to us. He was sort of
just
speaking out loud.
Modern football as a concept is just answering the question for all of us. And the pause between modern football and no.
Oh, the modern. Oh,
sensational.
Was there anybody on the post? Modern football. Love it.
Usually, the key elements of the game's gone are sort of peripheral elements to football. You know, your flash cars or your coloured boots or whatever it is. But this is quite a specific and, dare I say, nerdy tactical element to the game's gone, which I don't think you really get many other places. I suppose there's things like, I don't know, would playing out from the back, does that classify as as games gone?
Yeah,
or
JP definitely doesn't like playing out from the back. I sympathise, but he's definitely not a fan.
It's very much in the same bracket because it's something that is glaringly obvious. When it goes wrong, you look silly. But you never get Jonathan Pearce going, and why was that defender positioned there in the 6-yard box? Modern football? Because we've looked at the numbers and that's the best way to do it.
We all know that, you know, the average weight, you know, the sheer weight of numbers of people who probably agree with him probably justify the opinion alone. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it was a real highlight of Match of the Day for me. Next up, a topical question from Toby Warner, Nick. He says, what's the footballing equivalent of drafting in the army during a national crisis?
Maybe Jimmy Hill jumping from the stands and being a linesman.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Is that
getting any qualified referee in from the stands?
Yeah.
In their civvies.
Yeah, put like is there a doctor on board? Is there a linesman in the stadium? And then there's Jimmy. Yeah.
That's very good. Dave, can you provide any advance on this?
Maybe not entirely what you're going for, but I was thinking about this. And is there actually a similarity between drafting in the army and, like, the situation where Liverpool last year played their entire youth team in a cup? Basically, you know, you're sending the kids to war.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, picking a demonstrably weakened side to get yourself through a situation. Yeah, quite like that. A couple other suggestions, Nick, were for Sam Allardyce. But that's firefighter, so that's a different arm of the emergency people.
Yeah, that's not
kind of that. He's not the army.
No, it's a life or death situation, isn't it? When you get the firefighters in, you need to put the fire out. Whereas the army, it's is a different sort of situation. It's like all society is broken down and we need to call in these lads to come and prop it all up again.
On that note then, my suggestion was Gerald Krasner being appointed as your club's administrator. I mean, it's only him or Trevor Birch. Trevor Birch is doing something more important now. So yeah, Gerald Krasner, the only club administrator I can name. Administration does feel a little bit similar to the ongoing fuel crisis.
Yeah, because there's a sort of, there's a sort of rationing element to it. There's like, we can't have any, we've bad stuff's going on. We can't have any nice things. We've got to strip it down to basics and have exactly what we need to survive and not a penny or a morsel more.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Good question from Toby Warner and well answered everybody else. Just to prove that there is no job too small for the Football Clichés podcast, Colin Thomas asks, which players and under which circumstances can stick to their task? What does sticking to your task mean?
Like a defensive midfielder who's been asked to man mark, like Ander Herrera did it under Mourinho, didn't it, against Chelsea or something like that.
Across a whole game?
Yeah, like he's been given a task and he's got to stick to it.
I think...
Interesting.
I definitely think it's a defensive thing, isn't it?
Agreed.
Or potentially... Well, I kind of immediately... It is right. I think it's only defensive midfielders that this can apply to because, you know, the modern game and all that, you know, fullbacks are asked to, you know, to do a lot of attacking and so on. Maybe you could say, like, I'm thinking an away tie in Europe, you're playing 4-5-1 and the lone striker has to do a lot of kind of running between, you know, in the line of the penalty box and hold the ball up and stuff. That feels like they're sticking to a task.
Rather more towards putting a shift in.
Yeah, possibly. But yeah. You've still got to... I'm also, on the defensive midfielder thing, I call to mind, I can't remember who it was, but it was a Tottenham player scored a screamer for at Chelsea a few years ago, and he got a bollocking from Harry Redknapp for being out of position, because he was supposed to be kind of...
Was that Sandro?
Could have been, yeah.
Should I pronounce it Sandro? Sounds a bit like Sandra.
Sandro.
Sandro. Let's say Sandro. Yes.
That sounds about right. But yeah, that springs to mind instantly, I think.
Okay. The scenario I had in my head was a fullback diligently stopping a cross coming in. So an isolated incident. This is not an ongoing thing. The task isn't the 90 minutes. It's the individual act of stopping a cross by tracking a winger all the way and doggedly stopping that cross coming in. That's the sticking to the task I had in mind.
I think the sticking implies a longer duration, I think.
No, because there's endurance within that isolated incident itself. They stuck to the task for a good 10 to 15 yards, made sure that cross didn't come in.
Okay.
And that requires an element of perseverance, I think, because you could give up.
Good. Yeah.
Stuck to his task. If you hear the words, you can see the scenario in your head already. I didn't want to pull rank here, but and that's it.
Okay.
But Colin Thomas, I hope you're satisfied because you got 2 6 out of 10 answers and 1 8 out of 10 answer. So that's the important thing. Sorry. Johnny Nixon, next up. Really enjoyed this one, Dave. He brought my attention to TalkSport 2's commentary for Everton versus Norwich at the weekend. Now, this is a very good example of a phrase that doesn't need to exist. Plenty of clichés exist for kind of the purposes of, you know, understanding what people are talking about, giving a gist of what it is they're on about. But this is a very peculiar footballing phrase that serves no function whatsoever. It doesn't serve to emphasise anything. It doesn't illustrate anything. It just isn't needed. And I also think that when people use it, they don't really know what it means. And this could be the ultimate example. Anyway, he says, the commentator remarked on Tim Krul having not saved a shot in anger. Can you save a shot in anger? Why do people even say that anyway, let alone here?
I think the proper way to use it, right, if you're saying he hasn't even had a shot in anger...
Yeah, exactly.
You can sort of, if you're frustrated and you're like not getting any good quality chances or whatever, you could just sort of smash one in. Oh, I'm just going to shoot from anywhere. I'm so annoyed the situation. I'm just going to have a shot in anger. I'm angry. I'm just going to shoot.
I've never even thought about what it means. Do you think that's what it is? It's like he didn't even do it in anger, let alone constructively.
Yeah, I sort of think that's kind of the sort of what it's getting at. But it doesn't. Yeah, it's hard. Saving a shot in anger.
You not having that.
You need to have
not having.
You need to have the shot.
Punching it away.
Exactly. What would you do?
Go away.
Just a routine shot that's just trickling towards him, and he angrily boots it away.
A goalkeeper can make a save in it. Say his defence has kind of, you know, there's a enormous holes opened up in the defence. Player comes clean through. The keeper advances, and you know, I'm thinking Peter Schmeichel here. And you know, angrily bats it away like he's some kind of giant bear.
I'm just perturbed by its usage generally, but in this case, it seems like a flagrant example. Let's ban that from football. Let's just ban it. It doesn't serve any purpose. I often throw down such edicts like this, but maybe it is time to open our minds a little bit when it comes to the language of football, Dave. Because last week I noted that BBC Sports Sound tweeting a goal alert from Rangers versus Livingston, and they said Alfredo Morelos scores the doubler for Rangers, making it his fourth goal of the season. Now, instinctively, I kind of raged against it. I thought, I can't have this. But then I thought about it a little bit more, because we spend so much time on this podcast dunking on new/brave footballing terminology. Maybe we should be a little bit more accepting. The doubler's really good. I like the doubler.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think the doubler, it definitely works. But it also sounds like a kind of... It could be the banter nickname for someone in your Sunday league team or something like that. I don't really know where it would come from.
I dread to think what image you have in your head there, but Dave, you've gone curiously silent.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, like, they hear it in commentary. It's fine sort of written down, but you could be, it's a goal, and that's the doubler.
It's really good. Of course it works. You've got the opener, and then you have the doubler. I like the doubler. You wouldn't go tripler. Of course.
Oh, yeah. It's not silly. The trebler.
Very specifically to be used in a circumstance where it's going from 1-0 to 2-0.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely not a, you know, 2-1 to 3-1 situation. Definitely should be no room for interpretation. It should be very strictly controlled. That's what I'm saying.
It can't be someone's personal doubler, so you can't.
No,
if a striker scores the first and the third in, you know, a 3-1 win or something like that, no. It can't be his own doubler. It has to be right.
No, this is a game state situation. Definitely, there's probably other ways of you know, bagging a brace, etc. But yeah, I like the doubler. I'm going to start using it wherever I can. So watch out. Moving on, the concept of the six-pointer, Dave, has pervaded more across the continent than I'd ever thought. Here to set the scene is Thomas Tuchel before Chelsea versus Manchester City.
Well, it is a six-pointer between two teams.
So Tuchel's happy with six-pointer. I mean, it was put to him, I have to say. So he was basically repeating it back, but right. He's obviously familiar with the phrase. So that was a little bit of a surprise to me that he kind of, maybe I'm being very naive here, but that he knew what the concept of a six-pointer was. So that's quite reassuring.
Sort of thing that they would probably have a word for in Germany, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I did sort of think, as you say, he's comfortable with it, so he gets it. But yeah, I did think he's probably more likely he's just picked it up since he's been here. But Chelsea are not.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I always associate six-pointers with teams down the bottom.
No, you're very, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. That's very much the tradition.
But there's no reason why you shouldn't use it, you know.
No, I mean, it's the same concept. Yeah. Same idea. But Nick, speaking of relegation battles, Juventus' sluggish start to the Serie A season left them languishing towards the bottom end of the table. And Massimiliano Allegri, speaking ahead of Juventus' 3-2 comeback win over Spezia last week, before the match he was asked about how important this game was for their objectives for the season. And he, of course, said, Aguardare classifica uno scontro salvezza. And scontro salvezza literally translates as clash for salvation. What a phrase. We need that.
How good
is clash for salvation?
100% need that. Don't let Sky Sports know about that. That'll be the next sort of big, you know, Sunday.
Salvation Sunday.
There was that period where they would always have Arsenal v Chelsea and Liverpool v United on the same... What Mega Sunday? What do they used to call it?
They used to have brand names for their double winners. Yeah. They don't do it anymore. It would have been red versus blue.
Unless it's Derby
like
Day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to engineer something where, you know, second bottom plays bottom and third bottom plays fourth bottom. Then, and there you go. It's been given
those convenient Super Sundays where it just happens to be the teams who need to play each other. We're moving on a tangent here because the saga doesn't end here. So, Dave, Allegri uses the phrase clash for salvation, which I quite like. Then I read about the story on the BBC website, and they just flagrantly translated it to relegation six-pointer. You can't just do that. You can't just say, I found this really... I mean, this is a crisis for journalism. You can't just do this. It's a very special phrase.
Well, and they, but they've quoting it via translation, and they've completely changed it.
It's definitely the same quote, and they simply took Scontra Salvezza, Clash for Salvation, and just changed it to relegation six-pointer. He absolutely did not say relegation six-pointer. Of course he did. Not even in Italian.
That's scandalous.
It is scandalous, isn't it?
I mean, there's a very fine line between kind of literal Google Translate and just inserting idioms that probably don't exist in the country.
It's just kind of just making Allegri sound like Harry Redknapp.
Incidentally, if Juventus's travails continue, we're going to have to get someone to tell us what the Italian for "they'll be fine" is. Surely,
I mean. Could the Italians get more dramatic than "down to the bare bones"? I bet they've got something a little bit more evocative than that. But yeah, it troubled me. And so it just goes to show that that six-pointer perhaps hasn't pervaded Europe quite as far as we feared. Right, that was the adjudication panel. We took care of some small and medium-sized issues there, and I'm very delighted that we managed to provide some definitive resolution to it. Next up, we have a first for the Football Clichés podcast. Sort of a phone-in, in a way. Our first ever live caller on the Football Clichés podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Okay, so we're kind of dangerously close to talk sport territory here. This might be the first time I ever get to tell someone to turn their radio down as they call in. Really excited by that alone. But it's a very warm Football Clichés welcome to John Evans. How are you doing?
I'm really good, Adam. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Dave knows this story. Nick absolutely doesn't know this story, but that doesn't matter. Nobody listening knows it either. John, tell us the story you wrote to me about recently.
Oh, well, basically, when myself and two friends were 14 or 15, we decided to enter the world of professional transfers.
Right.
Why we did it, I can't think of any other better reason than it was a good laugh. Why we thought it would actually be successful is a totally different matter. It's insane, but it did actually work. We were all obsessed with lower league football. I'm an Oldham fan. My friend was a Bury fan. Oldham had been in the Premier League, but we were more obsessed with the lower leagues. Even now, I'm more interested in workman-like centre midfielders or box-to-box midfielders and stuff, and Panenkas and Rabonas.
Yep.
So we'd grown up with guys like Eric Hall and Mel Steen, football agents. We were playing the early versions of Championship Manager, and we figured that this transfer market must be a piece of cake. Let's give it a go. The catalyst was that Oxford United appointed a new manager. I believe his name was Malcolm Shotton. And okay. We figured that it might sound very naive, it might sound stupid. We figured that if we'd never heard of him, nobody else would. So we'll pretend to be the Oxford United manager and try and do some transfers. And as naive and stupid as it sounds, we were actually proved right. Nobody had heard of Malcolm Shotton. Right. It went from there.
So, okay, so... I mean, By what process did you do this? Was it? Did you go to a phone box? Did you call from your house?
Yeah, this was before the days of mobile phones, so there was a phone box. It's still there, probably about 2 miles behind. We would go armed with a pocket full of 20p's and 50p's and 10p's. And a crucial fact in this story, a football record book. Now, it wasn't the Rothmans. It was one of the cheap ones you could get. That was a
knock-off Rothmans?
A knock-off Rothmans.
Oh, this is a lovely little angle. Okay.
That gave us facts. It gave us details about loan spells. It gave us records of injuries and whether this guy would be suitable for our team. And then it was a case of choose a player, choose a team, ring the main number in this football records book and ask for secretary to be put through to the manager. And that was it. It was as simple as that. It worked every single time.
Every single time?
Every single time.
What kind of managers are we talking about here, just to kick off with?
You name them. We started off with the lower leagues because that's where we were comfortable. So we were going for people like Shrewsbury Town, Jake King, Stan Turnen at Bury, Andy Ritchie at Oldham. And then we moved up. You know, we started getting overconfident. We got Roy Evans. We got Martin O'Neill. We got Barry Fry.
That's amazing. Because, like, you know, especially the last three names here, Roy Evans, Barry Fry, Martin O'Neill. I mean, well, maybe less so Evans, but O'Neill and Barry Fry are not sort of characters I think who would take any nonsense. Be quite difficult people to kid. Like, you must have had a good way about you. And, like, did you... The first thing that sprung to mind when I heard this story was, did you put on a voice?
No. Never. No, we never put on voices. We never cracked. And I think this is... Just from being so obsessed with football from such a young age, you're fluent in the language of football cliches.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'd be stood around this phone box. And I don't want you to think this was three teenagers giggling around a payphone. You know, we all had our own deals going on with different managers. So the initial contact was crazy. So you'd ring the secretary, you'd say, look, I'm new to the job. I don't have any contacts. Please, could you put me through to a manager's office? At that point, it was a case of holding your nerve. You know, the phone's ringing in the manager's office. Is he going to buy it? Every time they did, yes. So we'll use Jake King as an example at Shrewsbury. You just got into it with him. You know, you started talking about the mess your predecessor had left, the problems of working around the lower leagues, the chairman's being tight with his purse strings.
And then did you use the word purse strings?
Just probably to be clear.
God, I wish you had.
But then
that would have been fine.
We knew plausible transfers as well. You know, we'd seen these players for years. I knew about Tony Rigby at Bury. I knew about Devon White at Shrewsbury Town. And so we would ask, you know, what's the availability of Devon White? And someone like Jake would give you, Devon's a crucial part of our team. You know, he's a fucking great lad, Devon. That's the one quote that always sticks in my mind. Devon White is a fucking great lad. And we would ask about what kind of fees he was interested in. And, you know, he'd give us a figure, and then we'd say, you know, it's a bit steep. We'll have to go and speak to our chairman. I'll call you back tomorrow. Sometimes they would give you a direct price. You know, sometimes you would make an offer and he'd have to go to his chairman.
What sort of figures are we talking about here?
Oh, you know, up to... I remember making an inquiry for Andy Priest from Stockport, and it was 200,000.
You're just saying this really breezily, which is the best bit of this story.
It's something that I've lived with for like 20 years. Sometimes it still makes me laugh. Yeah, so that's how it would go about. If we arranged to call the next day, we would give him a telephone number's phone number, and we would be stood outside a telephone box waiting for, say, Cambridge United manager to see if our bid for a centre-half had been accepted.
Absolutely
and things.
Sensational.
It was fantastic.
How old were you at this time, just to be clear?
I must have been 13, 14, 15.
I literally cannot think of something more fun to do as the age of 13 or 14.
Oh,
ring
fantastic.
Up football clubs trying to buy their football players as a prank. So, you know, you started fairly kind of conservatively. You were sort of tapping up lower league managers.
Yeah.
You thought they might be a bit easier to win round, but then you started to kind of get a bit braver. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, nobody had a clue. And also at this point, we then realised that nobody knows who Malcolm Shotton at Oxford is. Nobody knows who any of these lower league managers are. So we just pretend to be anybody. I have told this story to someone before and I got mixed up. We rung Kevin Keegan once, and we got to his answer phone. And boys being boys at this time, it's the only mistake we made. My friend thought it would be highly amusing to leave my home phone number instead of a phone box number. And when Kevin Keegan rung back to answer our inquiries, my mum answered the phone. He asked for John, and she got told that John was at school.
Kevin Keegan, very much the constant running theme of great content on this podcast. I'm glad he's popped up. I mean, so how high up did this go?
I think that we got the phone number for Alex Ferguson at the Cliff. That was a nerve-wracking phone call, but he never answered and he never replied. I think Martin O'Neill is probably the highest profile one. Roy Evans, training ground number at Liverpool, we definitely got. When we called the Premier League managers, we'd be inquiring about promising loan players, you know, who'd be gain experience for coming down the lower leagues for a month.
Good move.
In those days, loan periods were a month, weren't they? So, yeah, that's how we'd go about the bigger manager. But the lower league, we were always a little bit more guarded because they were our rivals. And we were really good at it, really good at it. It culminated as well. My friend called up and placed a bid. He actually called Oxford and he placed a bid for Nigel Jemson. I think he offered a swap deal for a guy called Tony Rigby.
Swap deal? Bloody hell.
And anyway, this gained a bit of interest. You know, the phone calls went backwards and forwards for a few days. And then, it went dead and we got bored of doing this and went quiet. And lo and behold, a couple of months later, Nigel Jemson signed for Bury for £100,000.
Absolutely.
Astonishing.
Sensational.
There are two things that have sprung to my mind. One is that I'm impressed that you managed to do this without, by the sounds of it, without the service of a usable fax machine.
Yes.
And if I was the manager involved, this is where I would smell the rat. But the other thing that I really enjoying is, like, it's, let's say 3 weeks after this, Shrewsbury play Oxford.
Yeah.
And the two managers start having a conversation and they say, oh, are you still interested in Devon White? And there'd be, what do you mean, Devon? No, what do you mean I'm not interested? No, I've never been interested in Devon White. No, but we spoke on the phone the other week. What, did we not? I thought you said you were interested in, and he wasn't available, but he might be available now. So, and then the absolute bafflement before a game or, you know, in the traditional.
The ripples that were sent through English football by this.
Well, I assume that's exactly what happened with Nigel Jemson. if you Google search Nigel Jemson transfer, the stories are there. It's actually reported in the press, and Jemson did sign. But yeah, but I'm sure there were times when I was at Oldham games or my mate was at Bury games when the managers who we'd been speaking to not the day before were there. And we never cracked. We never told them it was a joke.
That's the best thing about this is your sheer discipline throughout.
Well, we began to take it quite seriously. You know, we were interested if we could tempt a winger from Scarborough or something like that. You know, it became quite a challenge to just see how far along the line we could get with this.
I've got an image of you and your mate sort of popping down to the phone box every day, all dressed in suits with briefcases, sitting on a bench with your papers.
The other image I quite like is if you've got, as you say, you go to the game and the manager you've been speaking to from the phone box just days before is in front of you, and you start shouting or heckling, and the manager suddenly goes, "Hang on a minute, I know that voice."
Now, this detail may be lost to the mist of time, but to ask you anyway, give me a sort of range of expenditure here. How many 20p's are we talking? How much did you spend on ringing football clubs trying to buy their players?
Oh, guy, in those days, you know, a pound was a lot, wasn't it, to spend in a phone box? So, yeah, I was trying to remember when this actually happened, and it must have been like half term and around those types of, you know, maybe coming towards the end of a transfer window. But yeah, it must have been like every day for, I'm guessing, like 2 or 3 months.
Do you ever think to yourself, did that actually happen? Was it all a dream? Am I just imagining this? Because obviously, I'm convinced by your retelling of it, but it's the sort of thing that if I did it, I think I might get to an age and think, did we actually do that?
Yeah. Like I say, even now, it still makes me laugh when I think about it. When I can still hear Jake King's voice in my ear saying, Devon White, yeah, he's a fucking great lad. You know, it'd be great for the dressing room and things like
inner
that.
In a circle. This is absolutely sensational. Okay, so I've done some very, very crude maths here.
Yeah.
So if you were making, say, 3 phone calls a day trying to sign players for your non-existent football club for 3 months, it's only about 50 quid.
Yeah.
If you said to a 13-year-old, here's 50 quid, go and have the best summer of your entire life, I think that's pretty much good value.
And we were also getting calls in return as well. You know, we'd be... But one of the tricky... I do remember one of the tricky things we did was, obviously, there was no phone number showed up. You know, the phone would ring. We didn't know which manager it was. We were deep into this. You know, we had deals going with four or five clubs. And one of us would just have to pick up the phone, and they never even twigged on
that.
These guys were so desperate to do deals.
When you picked up the phone, did you have a... Did you just say hello? Did you say Oxford United or hello... Malcolm Shotton speaking.
Yeah, it'd be like, hello, Malcolm Shotton speaking. Or if we knew who was calling at a time, we would just say, oh, hiya, Jake, you know, and try and bring it on them. Yeah, we were, I can't believe how good we were at it. And like I said, we never slipped up.
You should have created this narrative that Malcolm Shotton was really tight and reversed the charges. Imagine like calling up Sir Alex Ferguson or something. Say, will you accept this reverse charges come from Malcolm Shotton?
The other thing I do sometimes feel, I do sometimes feel a bit sorry for Malcolm Shotton. You know, this is his first his first job, and I don't know if we made it more difficult for him or what, but poor Malcolm Shotton.
Are you still friends with the guy that you used to do this
I've
with?
Lost, I still see one of them out and about every now and then. I've lost touch with the other one.
What do you say when you see him? What do you say?
How do you possibly talk about anything else when you see them?
I don't know. We were friends for 15, 20 years after we did this. And we just stopped talking about it. Just never
what better it. Bond could there be?
it does make me laugh when I see just how pedantic football is now, when you can't even speak to the players. And in those days, it was literally three 13-year-olds with 20 P's and a yearbook getting quite highly involved in professional transfers.
Here's another question. How long did these conversations ever go on for long enough for, and this is one for the kids, for the pips to start going in your, so you had to put another 20p?
Oh, yes. Sometimes we were on the phone for a long time with these guys. You know, it wasn't like a 2-minute, would you be interested in selling Ian Culverhouse? No. Okay, goodbye. Well, we'd then start talking about who would be available in the squad and things like that, and weaknesses we had in our own squad. You know, we knew the injury situation. If someone had been injured, we were quite capable of pushing them for further information or other suitable players they might be able to send us. You know,
did anyone ever put you on the back foot? Like, because I'm imagining, like, someone's asked you a question you don't know the answer to, but you're thumbing through your knockoff Rothmans in the manner of a radio caller on a quiz who's on Google, and there's a suspicious pause between them and then very confidently answering 5 seconds later.
I don't want to make up answers because, you know, I'd be casting my mind back, but I can never remember being caught out. I can, like I say, I dare say any of you guys could just do it tomorrow. When you can talk in football,
I'm going to try.
When you're talking football cliches, you can hold a conversation. You know, you can talk rubbish. You can say a lot without saying much with these guys. They speak in a totally unique language.
So, two more things to ask. First of all, I kind of put it to you that at the age of 13 to 14, when you're kind of sort of mindlessly devouring a Rothmans or the equivalent and playing something like Championship Manager, mm-hmm. your kind of knowledge, your kind of encyclopedic knowledge of football, current football, probably can't get more definitive than that.
No.
At your age now, could you possibly list that many players?
Impossible.
And where they are and what they're doing?
No, impossible. At that time, we were collecting, do you remember pro set cards, the early trading cards? We were collecting those and reading the back of them. And
the perfect amount of information you'd need.
Yeah. So we knew every player from the lower leagues just by looking at these pro sets or playing Championship Manager from 1996, 97, whatever it was. We knew everything. We probably knew more about the lower leagues than Martin O'Neill. You know, as crazy as it sounds.
Did your parents ever get wind of it? They were like, what are you doing down that phone box all day?
I used to tell them, yeah. Like, my mum answered the phone to Kevin Keegan, didn't she? But I used to go home and say, oh, we've just had Roy Evans on the phone. Yeah, just laugh.
In a fascinating circle of life situation for this podcast, the former Newcastle defender John Anderson, who we featured earlier in this episode for his sensational co-commentary, once had his cheekbone shattered by Malcolm Shotton. Did you realise at the time that Malcolm Shotton, it turns out, had one of the most feared reputations as a player? So if he ever found out, did you ever worry about him finding out?
Yeah. When you're that age, you worry about everything. You worry about them tracing. Are you going to trace the phone? And is he someone going to turn up at the phone box? But no, I can honestly say everybody, nobody was difficult to speak to. I don't have a bad memory of any single person we spoke to. I don't remember anybody just shutting us off and being rude. everybody was very willing to do business with these three 13, 14-year-olds.
It's a sensational. If Malcolm Shotton did have this reputation for being a hard man, you can imagine Jake King or whoever answering the phone goes, oh, he sounds surprisingly like a 13-year-old boy for someone who's smashing jaws all over the place.
Yeah, it's definitely a post-voice-breaking endeavour, isn't it? Definitely. Well, there you go. John Kia Jerupchian Evans. Absolutely sensational story. I'm really glad we did this. If anyone ever has a story to rival this, please get in touch and we might make this a semi-regular feature. But John, thanks for joining us. Absolutely stunning stuff. And well done. Well done on your discipline. Well done on your research.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I hope people enjoy. It's always made me laugh over the years.
Well, there's only one thing left for this episode, Nick, and that is Premier League Years Playlist Bingo. You know the drill by now. I want a number between 1 and 1,379.
I'm going to have 578, please.
Wow. In Your Eyes by Kylie Minogue.
This is very, very Premier League Years.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
So... This is quite low down the list. Well, maybe we're sort of maybe turn of the millennium, I guess.
Is this, yeah, like
2001
post Can't Get You Out of My Head, sort of second or third single off that album. She's had a big smash comeback hit. Yeah.
I think this is...
I'm lost for this one. I don't know the scenario.
I think this is kind of maybe successful club in some kind of turmoil, perhaps about to sack a manager or something.
All I've got is a close-up of a manager's eyes. At
yeah.
The moment she says, in your eyes.
Possibly...
It's a montage of, you know, Chelsea losing a load of games or something.
Yeah, maybe, actually, this is a good point. Maybe it's one of their special little montages they do, Dave, of certain things happening, like... Not bloopers necessarily in this situation.
No,
a very specific type of thing happening, and they make a little montage of it for that season.
I think
they just drop it in out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't necessarily think the In Your Eyes thing has a relevance to, as we've said, the title doesn't often relate to the thing. I think it's just probably just a song of the time with an appropriately sort of upbeat sort of dance sort of tempo to it that they can just sling under something that they need to run for 45 seconds.
Okay, so yeah, some very important matters covered. A mouse would beat a cat by default at a game of chess. That's well established. There are no cup finals in Formula One, again. David Seaman will continue to chuckle forevermore. And Malcolm Shotton has something to answer for, or at least something to find out about and get very angry about indeed. Thanks very much to you, Dave, for joining us for the adjudication panel today.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Nick.
Thank you.
See everyone for episode 99.
The Athletic.